Here's an enormous irony that is very easy for climate activists to overlook. Moving past our dependence on oil as a fuel source with a serious environmental cost will require us to embrace energy storage options whose extraction is associated with serious and highly toxic pollution, metals and minerals including lithium, copper, nickel, and manganese. Can we manage the consequences of dig, baby, dig more responsibly than drill, baby, drill? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. The mining industry has been reinvigorated by this growing demand for commodities buried deep underground. But as my guest has learned, the challenges go beyond just finding these resources. This new world of renewable energy and enormous batteries could cause radical changes in the global balance of wealth. Nick Bolin is a freelance journalist and correspondent for High Country News. His article, A Good Prospect, was published by The Drift. Nick, welcome to Think.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So in this story, you take readers along to the largest annual mining conference in the world, which was held this year in Toronto. What stood out to you about the vibe there?
So, yeah, this conference, the shorthand is PDAC, stands for the Prospectors and Developers Association of Canada. And it's kind of where, you know, the mining, it's a good place to get a temperature check on the mining industry every year. And this year it was just consumed top to bottom by excitement about the amount of money that the global metal mining industry is going to make off of, you know, just kind of at this point, what seems like basically bottomless demand for what we could generally call battery metals, with copper, as you said in the intro, copper, lithium, cobalt, manganese, nickel as kind of the highlights. But you know, that there was a consultant there from McKinsey who gave kind of the opening keynote address, who expects over the next decade or so $15 to $20 trillion in kind of increased revenue for the industry, because of the green metals boom and the transition away from fossil fuels.
Yeah, this piece really came as a revelation to me, because if we're not paying close attention, I think a lot of people could be forgiven for thinking about mining as a kind of throwback industry, but it doesn't have to be coal they're mining, right?
No, this is very much not kind of the bad old days of old King Coal. You know, that this industry, you know, at this conference, coal, you know, barely mentioned at all, except as a kind of, you know, relic of the past. You know, they see themselves as, you know, kind of one of the most important kind of load bearing industries when it comes to powering the world for the next century. And the thing is that, you know, they're not wrong. You know, I think I don't have the exact figure, but I think it was more than 80% of global energy generated last year was you know, some form of fossil fuel combustion. And so, you know, if that continues, the scale of the climate crisis is going to be enormous. And so when the mining industry says, you need us to transition away from fossil fuels and to prevent the climate crisis, that's both something that mining executives tend to say because they want to mine. But they're also, you know, they're also right about that the scale of the transition from fossil fuels is going to require this just gigantic amount of battery metals. And metal miners stand to make a lot of money off of that in the next 100 years. You know, someone described copper as the new oil at this conference. And I thought that was kind of striking, simply because, you know, I think the lay listener of this show probably knows the names ExxonMobil and Chevron, but probably doesn't know the names Glencore, you know, BHP, Barrick, you know, these giant metal miners. But in the next 100 years, I wouldn't be surprised if those companies kind of become everyday names in the same way that oil companies were kind of everyday names in the 20th century.
Is any of this money pouring into the mining industry at the moment being diverted from investments in oil and gas extraction?
That's a good question. It's hard to piece it out. And, you know, a lot of the new, at least new investments from, you know, domestically in the U.S., The most obvious is the Inflation Reduction Act, the Biden administration's kind of big climate bill, which is not, I wouldn't say diverting from oil and gas, but definitely creating a kind of public stream of revenue and incentives towards metal mining. And you can already see some, you can see some companies take, trying to kind of bridge this divide. ExxonMobil actually applied for permits to drill for lithium in Arkansas recently. So they're trying to kind of have it both ways. And then I actually saw that there was an advertisement, and forgive me, I don't remember exactly the source, but I believe it was from a car maker that was kind of calling into question electric cars, but kind of that the oil and gas industry does see some threat when it comes to EVs. So this is all kind of happening really quickly, that this green metals boom is kind of happening as we speak. So piecing out the financing can be a little hard, but it's definitely safe to say that when it comes to electric cars, especially, the big automakers are investing really, really heavily in their supply chains, creating deals in South America and in Western Africa, signing deals with the mining companies. This is Ford, GM, the big boys, they're definitely signaling that they see the future in EVs. And I guess that would be, taking financing away from gas powered cars.
So just to go back for a minute to the Inflation Reduction Act and the provisions to incentivize mining for battery metals, I mean, are these strictly necessary to provide sufficient materials to meet U.S. automakers' demand for big batteries, or could we assume the market alone would drive the necessary activity?
That's a good question. I think that part of, the market is definitely going in that direction. There's no question. Part of this was, framed to kind of jumpstart, kind of less on the mining side and more on the electrical generation side to encourage, solar panels and wind farms and various things like that. But part of the other thing, and this was very obvious at this conference, is that, the kind of industrialized Western world for a very long time has relied on, has kind of, let the market take its course. And what that has resulted in is an enormous amount of the mining, processing, and production of battery metals and rare earth metals being done in China. And the Biden administration has been, fairly hawkish when it comes to its relationship with China. And along with some of the other Western countries that have kind of where the mining countries are mining companies are headquartered, but production doesn't take place, there seems to have been a kind of recent panic about the extent to which they rely on China as a kind of crucial place in the supply chain. So Canada, the US, Australia, Switzerland, the UK, they've all been kind of recent news of them kicking out Chinese mining companies, about them investing in domestic processing. China refines more than half of the world's lithium and controls 85% of the rare earth processing. And it's pretty clear that Western governments are kind of closing ranks against China. There's a lot of people who say it's way too little, too late. But that's one way to see the Inflation Reduction Act as an attempt to kind of throw money at a domestic battery metal processing industry that right now in the U.S. doesn't really exist. So, and that, you can't snap your fingers and do that. So, we might have to be 10, 15 years down the road to see if it actually worked. But that is one of the reasons why, the IRA kind of isn't leaving it up to the market, as you say. Because they're trying to create, they're trying to divert some of these industries to do things domestically in a way that, for the past 20 years or so, these companies in the U.S. have been happy to let China do the dirty work. Basically, it's really not it's pretty nasty stuff to process lithium, And now we're kind of now the Biden administration's freaking out about that.
So to the extent that China is making inroads with investments in mining far beyond its own borders, what kinds of demands are the countries that have those buried stores of lithium and copper and other metals able to make in order to seal deals with these Chinese-run mining operations?
That's a great question. So, you know, like I said, China has been investing in overseas, in building a kind of complete, you know, overseas supply chain for its battery metals for a long time now. Their Belt and Road Initiative, especially in Western Africa, you know, that started in the early to mid 2000s, and they have, you know, they have huge, you know, often tied in with the state, companies that have cobalt and copper projects in Western Africa, that and these companies rival any of the Western, you know, heavyweights in terms of market capitalization. And so, you know, they especially in the Congo, you know, they've got just gigantic mines, and they are, you know, there was a recent report which I wrote about where the Congolese government accused China of basically not delivering on its side of the bargain. You know, so it will allow you to operate, but you need to provide X billion of dollars. $1 billion for infrastructure improvements. The Congolese government accused the Chinese of not holding up their side of the bargain, and China, you know, it seems wary of losing those mining deposits, even though they hold an enormous amount of sway in that region. You know, they're going to up their kind of investment in the Congo. But this is pretty common. You know, the U.S. Is now kind of scrambling to do its own version of that. You know, that we sent the Secretary of State Blinken, Anthony Blinken, and Vice President Kamala Harris on a tour of Western Africa, which, if you read between the lines, you know, is just the spring, was basically to sign battery metals deals. They did so in Zambia and also with the DRC. You know, so a lot of these Western governments, Germany sent its chancellor to Chile within the past 6 months to kind of promise the Chilean lithium industry that it would, you know, that Germany would invest in a domestic processing industry there rather than exporting the lithium in order to kind of secure its supply chain for all the big German automakers. So, you know, the Western governments and China, you know, everyone's doing it. They're all scrambling to see if they can divert the battery metals to them rather than their rivals. And this does mean that countries in the global South, whether that's, you know, Indonesia or, you know, the Congo or, you know, Chile and Bolivia and Peru and, you know, a lot of countries in South America that have a lot of lithium, it does give them some leverage. So you're kind of seeing a lot of geopolitical wrangling over this specific issue.
Can we assume there are national security anxieties along with national economic anxieties around this?
Yes. I mean, that has been how, you know, the Biden administration officials have framed their kind of more protectionist, more nationalistic policy when it comes to creating a battery metal industry. They have talked about it in national security terms. It's fair to say that you know, they have suddenly realized that they are kind of behind if they see themselves as competing with China for these metals and for control of the supply chain. They're definitely have kind of decades of playing catch up to do. And you know, S&P Global, the market research firm, you know, it expects copper demand to double by 2035 while supply dwindles. And in a recent report about copper, it called copper scarcity a key destabilizing threat to international security in the 21st century. So there's a lot of kind of people, you know, firms that watch this stuff that think that, you know, enormous demand and limited supply for battery metals are going to be a real national security and real national international kind of source of instability in this century.
Nick, can we assume there are national security anxieties along with national economic anxieties around this?
Yes. I mean, that has been how, you know, the Biden administration officials have framed their protectionist, more nationalistic policy when it comes to creating a battery metal industry. They have talked about it in national security terms. It's fair to say that they have suddenly realized that they are kind of behind if they see themselves as competing with China for these metals and for control of the supply chain. They're definitely have kind of decades of playing catch up to do. And you know, S&P Global, the market research firm, you know, it expects copper demand to double by 2035 while supply dwindles. And in a recent report about copper, it called copper scarcity a key destabilizing threat to international security in the 21st century. So there's a lot of kind of people, you know, firms that watch this stuff that think that, you know, enormous demand and limited supply for battery metals are going to be a real national security and real national international kind of source of instability in this century.
You know, you get a conference together of any kinds of professionals, right? Hairdressers or doctors or police officers, and there's people are going to feel good about themselves and the industry and everybody's in high spirits. This one, though, to you, this conference you attended of miners felt a little different. Can you talk about this concept of social license that is giving mining a renewed sense of itself as kind of essential in the world and possibly even like a beloved industry?
Yeah. So I think some of the context for that is what, you know, you brought up at the beginning, which is that some people may think of mining in terms of kind of this outdated coal industry, like the bad old coal barons. And, you know, so this is kind of the forward-looking metal mining, you know, heavyweights, and they, you know, talk about kind of, there was a lot of talk about perception of the industry, and one of the terms that was frequently thrown around was this phrase, social license to operate, which is tied, of course, to the sense that a company that is mining needs you know, legal license. They need permits from whatever, you know, government, state, country they're operating in. But they also need, you know, the approval, the goodwill of the populace. And it's very clear that the metal mining industry sees its way forward, sees its way to making these trillions of dollars. And it needs to ingratiate itself with a different sort of crowd than it historically has. And so this is basically the sort of people who want to buy electric vehicles to reduce their carbon footprint, or governments that want to, you know, address climate change. So it was framing itself as much more kind of socially conscious, as environmentally minded. You know, many of the big companies, Barrick, Newmont, Glencore, and so on, we're talking about their, you know, carbon neutral goals for their own operations, you know, by 2040, by 2050, you know, they have a carbon neutral target. They have efforts to increase the number of women that are employed in their ranks. They want to make it known that they care about the communities that are nearby their mines. And, you know, historically the mining industry has been, you know, an enormous force for displacing, you know, tribal nations and indigenous people all over the world. So there was a great deal of focus on, you know, kind of how the mining industry can be a good force for, you know, say a local tribe that suddenly has a nickel mine next door. You know, one of the sessions that I quoted in my story, was a direct quote. A session was titled, "Why Indigenous Women in Mining is a Golden Opportunity." So, you know, the mining industry is maybe aware of its former, you know, how it was perceived in the past. It sees this opportunity going forward, and it also sees the sort of people it's going to have to appeal to if it wants to be part seen as this friend when it comes to, you know, addressing climate change, which made for a very fascinating, you know, couple days for me reporting on it, simply because, you know, this is a pretty recent thing. I've reported on the mining industry for a little bit. It was my first time at this conference, but, you know, I talked to people and they were like, it was not like this 3 years ago. Hmm. You know, all this talk about electrification and also kind of the more maybe social justice framing for some of the panels and how mining is going to conduct itself, that this is a very rapid, this has been a pretty rapid shift in framing. That, you know, directly reflects the gravity of the climate crisis and the amount of money that the industry thinks it's going to make off of it.
So carbon neutral is good, right? It's what we, you know, many people are shooting for at this moment. It is not the same thing as non-polluting, right? Like an acid spill in the wetlands is carbon neutral. Mining still has some pretty stark effects on surrounding environments. Just as an example, tell us a little bit about what it takes to get lithium out of the ground and then process it into a form that manufacturers can use.
Sure. So lithium mining takes a couple different forms. If it's being extracted from a brine, which is pretty common, a lot of times brine, so it's in a brine underneath salt flats. This is very common in kind of high altitude deserts in South America. Chile has the largest known lithium deposits in the world, and the brine has to be extracted and then put into these evaporation ponds, where you know, the kind of the minerals and the other stuff that lithium's mixed with that, you know, isn't useful has to be kind of drained away, just leaving the mineral behind. And, you know, this can be an enormous water suck to what are already pretty arid climates. Lithium also is mined in giant open pit mines. You know, just kind of imagine a giant hole in the ground. That's most of the mining that takes place in Australia. And, you know, it's a big burden on the landscape. It's a big water use. And this goes for copper, where, you know, copper mines also tend to be open pit mines. And where, you know, the heavy metals that, you know, copper deposits are mixed with, you know, when it's exposed to the air and taken out of the ground, can lead to sulfuric acid runoff and arsenic. And just this whole host of toxic metals that kind of, once the mine is open, you know, you have to have treatments that ensure that these don't run off into local groundwater that are, you know, run well past the life of the mine itself. The other one I wanted to kind of call attention to your listeners is nickel, which is a really important battery metal, and that is just, you know, kind of similar to copper, is just kind of gigantically, you know, polluting. And there was a recent story in the Washington Post where Indonesia has a gigantic supplies of nickel, but it creates these hazardous waste ponds that are full of that are full of toxic metals. And this is in a country that regularly receives typhoons, where flooding and enormous rain can, you know, it's easy to imagine them breaking down an earthen dam, you know, these waste ponds overflowing. Indonesia's initial plan for the toxic waste from its nickel industry was to pump it into the ocean. It has, as far as I know, has backed off of that plan. But there is this kind of enormous ecological burden that comes with metal mining that is separate from the climate crisis and, you know, doesn't do anything to reduce the amount of metals we need to get away from burning fossil fuels. You know, our kind of exploding demand for these metals in the industrialized West is really going to kind of inflict these extractive forces predominantly on the global South and on countries that are much more impoverished than in the industrial North.
Is the water used in processing these mined materials effectively contaminated in perpetuity, or can it be processed and made useful again for other purposes?
I mean, if you talk to the mining industry, they're always talking about re-mining, kind of, you know, already injured sites to, you know, kind of see what useful heavy metal, what useful rare earth metals might remain. But, you know, that phrase you use, in perpetuity, you know, I quote it in my story. It comes from this, it's the largest open pit copper mine in the U.S., possibly one of the largest ones in the world. It's in Utah. It's called Bingham Canyon. And, you know, it's closed, you know, it's not economically, you know, useful, but the pollution from this site is going to need to be treated, you know, as far as we know, until, you know, the end of time, thousands of years, to prevent all of these toxic heavy metals from entering the local groundwater. And this isn't really something that the mining industry will talk about, how environmentally conscious it is, but it is, you know, it's still digging a hole in the ground and pulling metals out. And this is going to have tremendous environmental consequences to ecosystems, to groundwater, to poisoning. You know, there's a long history of unsafe mining being a source of poisoning local communities through various ways. So, yeah, I mean, this is, even as the industry tries to frame itself as an ally in the climate crisis, there is this issue of its, you know, undeniable environmental impacts, that if you look at the size of some of these mines, you know, they're hard to ignore, but they're easier to ignore when, you know, they're not happening in our backyard in the U.S., when we only see the electric cars and we don't see the mines in Indonesia.
What is South America's lithium triangle?
So that's a very important part of this whole dynamic. The lithium triangle is it's an area of those kind of high desert salt flats that I described, where lithium occurs in brine that spans three countries. It's Chile, Bolivia, and Argentina, and it's more than half, and, you know, some estimates put it up to 70% of the world's known lithium reserves are concentrated in that vicinity.
So why is it that having a lot of lithium or mining wealth potentially has empowered leftist politicians in parts of South America?
That's a great question. The mining industry's impact in that part of the world is, you know, just enormous. And there's a lot of anger. You know, so Chile has basically been the world's copper vendor for 100 years, and in a way that has benefited Europe and the U.S. and a lot of kind of, you know, countries in the industrial north, and in a way that has not really economically benefited the people of Chile. And so in the past probably 3 or 4 years, there's been a number of left-wing governments that have won elections in South America, where the candidate running made, I wouldn't say anti-mining sentiment, but cracking down on the mining industry's excesses, and crucially making sure that some of its economic benefits actually return to the people in these countries rather than just, you know, being shipped overseas, made that explicit part of their campaign. So this happened in Peru, it happened in Chile, it happened in Mexico, it happened in Colombia. That's just a short list. These governments have this long history of, you know, environmental impacts, of people being displaced, of these countries making billions of dollars, but it not benefiting the people to point to when in their campaigns. And the most kind of important, I would say, recent geopolitical development is that the government of Chile recently announced that it would be nationalizing its lithium industry. And this has a kind of long tangled history in Chile, where, you know, the last leftist president elected there tried to nationalize the copper industry, and was then deposed in a coup, which was supported by RCIA. You know, there's this longstanding conflict in Chile between politicians that, you know, want to try to, you know, nationalize these resources to help it's people and international business interests. And so the Chilean president, Gabriel Boric, announced that over the next 10 years or so, they'd be creating a national lithium company, and that there are two private companies currently operating in Chile. And both of those companies would have to sign some sort of agreement with the national lithium company, where the national lithium company would kind of take precedent, would be the majority shareholder, would own the minerals themselves, and they could private with a private company, but that the private company would be the minority partner.
There are other countries, as you mentioned in the piece, Nick, that are trying to avoid trading their supplies overseas, right? Places like Indonesia?
That's right. So this is another kind of example of this global trend of countries suddenly looking at these limited resources and saying, like, we need to kind of see how this is going to benefit us rather than just kind of letting the market sweep our resources away. So Indonesia, as I said, nickel is a really important battery metal, and it has a very fast growing battery industry built around nickel. And it banned nickel exports last year. And it is trying to create, according to reporting from Reuters, a sort of OPEC-like group in that region, along with the Philippines and some other countries, which also have a lot of nickel, to control exports, to control pricing, to kind of have a little bit more say over what happens to these resources. So you can see this in Chile's nationalizing its lithium. You can see this in the South Pacific with Indonesia and the Philippines and their attempts to either ban nickel exports, to add nickel export taxes, to create a domestic battery infrastructure. And you can see the U.S. doing it. Like the U.S. is, our Inflation Reduction Act, the IRA, is kind of our version of this. So it's happening all over the world as governments kind of see the divide between the demand and the supply of these resources.
Nick, prospecting has always been a financially risky proposition for the people who do it, but also for investors. Talk a little bit about the revival of prospecting as a profession.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, prospecting's always been around, and it's never going to go anywhere. It's just that the metal mining world is so cyclical that, the boom and bust cycle is very, with a lot of resources, that you can see this in oil and gas, and you'll see it in mining too. And so, I at this conference that I attended, it has everyone from the largest mining companies in the world down to kind of individual prospectors who are pounding stakes into the ground, setting out their claims in rural Canada and in other parts of the world. And if you talk to them, I mean, they're real gamblers, hoping that they're well-informed gamblers, but they're gamblers, hoping that they, find some deposit that a larger company maybe passed over, and that the whatever mineral is in that deposit is, become sought after, and then they can sell it for a whole bunch of money to a larger company or get someone to invest in their exploration. I was talking to these prospectors who basically say, there was a big metal market crash, 2014-15. And these guys say that, their credit cards are just trash. They wind up with thousands and thousands of dollars in debt, while the market's down, trying to, sell these claims, trying to find, like I said, kind of hidden deposits that are actually worth something. And then, like now, when the metal mining industry is, it's been boom times for the past couple of years, suddenly everything's great. They've got, capital markets guys who are willing to, capital markets investors willing to throw money their way. People are, the big companies are trying to buy lithium claims off of, whatever you got lithium wise, they'll buy it. And so it was interesting to hear about the metal mining industry from their perspective, because You know, they're not a billion-dollar company that can kind of ride the waves. It's just these, you know, these guys who are open to the whims of the market, and you know, they're very candid about, you know, the boom and bust cycles of natural resource commodities. And you know, right now it's times are good, but you know, you can already see how fluid this stuff is. So to give you an example, cobalt. You know, even before kind of the real green metals boom of the past 2 or 3 years, cobalt was a really important battery metal, but its stock rose just at this scalding pace. And, you know, when there's a boom, there's usually a bust after, and then the cobalt stocks just tanked over the past couple of years. And now, you know, if you go to this conference, there are a bunch of manganese. You know, you kind of walk the, and everyone's excited about manganese, you know, companies portraying themselves as, you know, the most advanced manganese mine in the US. And the reason is that there are some ways in which manganese can replace cobalt on the battery metals supply chain for, you know, its uses. And so, you know, something as well known as important as cobalt, you know, that there's a bust and something else, you know, is there to take its place, which I think is an important example just to demonstrate how quickly these commodity markets can shift, and that, you know, I don't think that lithium and copper demand is going anywhere, but it also doesn't mean that, you know, there's always a kind of level of built-in uncertainty.
So do the skills of prospecting or developing a mine translate from one material to the next? Like, will someone with expertise in, you know, developing a lithium mine be able to transition to copper or nickel or manganese?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, at the level of a kind of big company, I mean, yeah, they'll figure it out. Like, you know, they've got whole armies of geologists that can do this, even if the operations themselves are, you know, like I said, I mean, you know, even within lithium mining, there's lithium mining where you're extracting it from a brine, and there's lithium mining where you're doing it in an open pit and kind of, you know, just digging up the earth in a way that, you know, kind of you would think mining happens typically. I mean, it's definitely the case that, you know, I was talking to these prospectors who were gold and silver prospectors predominantly, and then suddenly everyone wants lithium. So, you know, they start learning about it, they start learning what to look for when it comes to deposits, and it's, you know, they go where the market is. But it also means that, you know, there is this kind of, you know, changeability, I guess. You know, they are operating at the whims of the market, and they have to figure stuff out as it goes along.
So I learned a new term in this piece, and that is artisanal mining, which is not what it sounds like. Explain what it means exactly.
So artisanal mining is a term essentially for small scale. So, you know, there's one of the ways to think about this is that in the US, where mining takes place, it's usually really big. It's usually a small amount of people doing really big, you know, really large scale mines with, you know, the most advanced technology. So, you know, gold mines in Nevada, just gigantic pieces of equipment digging up the earth. But in a lot of the rest of the world, the dynamics flipped. It takes a gigantic number of very poorly paid people with like picks and shovels digging out very small chunks of the minerals from the ground. And so artisanal mining often refers to small scale, often illegal operations. You know, this is very strongly associated with the Democratic Republic of the Congo, where 70% of the world's cobalt is produced. A lot of that comes from, you know, these illegal, they also produce a lot of copper. You know, hundreds of thousands of these miners, you know, digging with picks and shovels, they're handling toxic heavy metals with their bare hands, they're paid 20 cents a day, and just as about as awful as you can imagine. And the thing is that, you know, these small scale artisanal mines, the cobalt, the copper, whatever other minerals are produced there, through, you know, this opaque network of buyers and traders and processing firms, you know, these metals often find their way into the products of the largest companies in the world, into the phone that, you know, you and I and all our listeners have, into the electric cars you see on the streets. And, you know, Tesla, General Motors, they'll all talk a good game about, you know, making sure that child labor isn't part of their supply chain. You know, the IRA has various provisions to try to promote ethically sourced minerals. But, you know, you don't have to spend too much time scrutinizing in the industry to see that, you know, this stuff is very much still happening, that these metals that are produced by just really horrifying human rights violations are ending up in the products that we use every day, and that there's only so far that countries and companies are going to go to ensure that you know, these abuses aren't perpetuated, simply because there's so much money to be made. And the example I cite in my story is that Tesla shareholders rejected last year a proposal that would have required, you know, much more rigorous and detailed reporting on child labor and its mineral sources for its electric vehicle batteries. And that's not to pick on Tesla. You know, Ford and General Motors all have their own version of that.
So we're going to need these metals as we transition away from our reliance on fossil fuels, Nick. But one thing many people agree could quell the demand for these materials is to develop smaller vehicles that don't require such enormous batteries. Is that what American automakers are planning for?
They're not. You know, Americans love big cars, and there are also structural reasons why, you know, that there are kind of tax loopholes for larger companies, for these big automakers, when it comes to building SUVs. And, you know, there are reports that show that, you know, if you take a few steps, whether it's making smaller cars so that the batteries are smaller, or, you know, promoting more walkable cities, or some combination of those things, reducing car ownership and through various means, that, you know, these gigantic figures that are projected for demand for lithium and other battery metals over the next coming decades. The current White House estimate for demand for lithium and other EV battery metals is a 4,000% increase over the next couple decades. But that we could really cut into this by, promoting smaller cars, smaller batteries, more walkable cities, and that, you know, the effects on lithium demand, you know, could be pretty substantial. It does not seem like that's the way things are going. But there are, you know, in my story, you know, I cite I cite this report from University of California, Davis, that shows kind of concretely how, you know, if we take this development path, you know, if we kind of stick the way it's going, yeah, we're going to need all of, you know, the thousands and thousands of percent increase. But if we, you know, take these various steps, that we could shrink total lithium demand. And, you know, that doesn't seem to be the way things are going. In April, GM announced that it would be ending production of the Chevy Bolt, which was a very popular small EV. And in its place, it's going to be building more electric trucks and SUVs. So the car companies seem to be going the opposite direction, but there are alternatives to this kind of gigantic global minerals rush where we tear up the planet for battery metals.
How readily recyclable are these minerals? Like, when my hybrid gives up the ghost in a few years, are all the minerals in the battery and the metals in the battery just spent, or can they be re-extracted and used again?
Recycling is a really crucial part of, you know, kind of any sustainable future for the battery metal industry, but there is no realistic sense that, you know, even if we achieved 100% recycling right now, that it could put a dent in demand. Like, the demand for these metals is so high that all of the lithium coming that could be reused from worn out batteries and so on. We just can't really recycle our way out of the problem, given the amount of existing fossil fuel infrastructure globally that we need to get offline. You know, that's just so, you know, vast majority of the world's energy sources are still from oil and gas and coal and propane. And to replace those with rechargeable batteries, you need lithium and copper. And perfect recycling of all of these metals won't get us there. Like, we need more. There's no question about that. The issue is, you know, just what is it going to do to the world to get all that we need? And that's the kind of tension at the heart of this green metals boom, where people who are climate and environmentally minded, you know, with all the goodwill in their heart, want to address the climate crisis. And then it is, you know, benefiting this other extractive industry that is going to, you know, unleash all sorts of extractive forces on the global South.
So for now, there's just no easy way around this.
I mean, like I said, there are these kind of projections where one might, you could see how we could get away from the kind of full, the full lithium demand that we, like, if global consumption rates stay the same, like on its projected path, like we could break off of that path and really reduce this, but there's no way to really recycle our way out of this problem. And, you know, saying that we're going to deindustrialize society so that we just don't need these metals to begin with, like, that's not, there's not much of a political constituency for that. So we need more of these, like, and to get them, we need to mine them. And there's not really a way around that.
Nick Bolin is a freelance journalist and correspondent for High Country News. His article published by The Drift is titled A Good Prospect. Nick, thanks so much for the conversation.
Thanks for having me on. It was fun.
You can find us on Facebook and Instagram by searching for KERA Think. Same search will get you to the podcast wherever it is you like to get podcasts, or you can listen to the podcast at our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.